of October 20th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 210, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York at the Apple Store, I'm Michael Giltz.
The Apple Store. So you're already waiting in line for...
That's right. Tomorrow, we're recording on Monday, and Tuesday, not just Apple, but Apple, Nokia, and Microsoft are all announcing new tablets.
They're all stepping on each other's toes.
They're like, my tablet is important. No, my tablet is important. I mean, we covered it when it first happened. That's how long the show's been around. We were there when the tablet debuted with the iPad back in April of 2010, where I brilliantly wondered if anybody would want one.
Well, right.
So at least I did admit I wanted one myself.
Yes, and I thought it was very interesting because I was at Sundance at the time for this particular episode, and I'd have to call it up. But where you said, I'm already online for the new iPad, and they hadn't even announced the name of it yet. It was January 2010.
The new thingamabob.
Yeah, and sure enough, the next day, it was called the iPad, and I thought, Michael knows something.
What? I had the name before it had a name?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, I think a lot of people were like, well, they'll never call it the iPad. I mean, that's
it just... sounds like a feminine product.
Right, exactly.
Well, 184 million tablets are going to ship this year. That's compared to 300 million PCs, but they think in a couple years that tablets will surpass PCs and laptops, I guess, as a dominant category. Amazing. They created an entire new category. Now everybody's got one. Almost half of Americans have a tablet or a reader, and a lot of them have two, like me. I have both a tablet and an e-reader.
Wow, you're just so first world.
Well, no, it's just, the way that impacts how we consume books and music and movies is important. So, you know, it goes far beyond Apple. It goes to how we access. Now we all want to be able to get our TV shows on our tablet, and we're angry that we can't. And they're rushing and pushing and trying to figure out ways to make that possible. And pretty soon, no matter where you are in the country, if you have cable service, you'll be able to go online and watch your TV shows.
Well, you know, Michael, we rarely talk about what we do over the weekends, but I did something this past weekend that I thought you would actually like and appreciate. I'm sure you know the band Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros.
I do. You saw them in concert, I guess.
I saw them in this in downtown Los Angeles. They took over a park, the Los Angeles State Historic Park, and they set up this big circus tent, and they performed inside. Now, I saw the Sunday matinee show, which was for children. It was like a family event, and they had jugglers, and it was like a big circus act, and Gwendolyn and the Good Time Gang, a preschool act, basically a preschool band played, and they were absolutely phenomenal. They performed in the round under this big circus tent, and the stage was revolving. It was phenomenal. It was a great way to see a show.
Who'd you see it with?
I saw it with my kids.
All right, cool. What did I do this weekend? I saw the new musical Fun Home, a new musical about a lesbian cartoonist whose father was a closeted gay man. That was at the Public, of course. On Saturday, I saw a revival of The Winslow Boy with Roger Reese, which was great, and an okay revival of How I Learned to Drive. And on Sunday, I saw the 1927 silent film Stark Love, which is from 1927. It was restored at MoMA. It's a new program led by Joshua Siegel, a friend of mine. It's to save and project is what they call it. It's where they always have an annual display of films that they've been able to preserve or other people have been able to restore and bring back to life. This was a pretty interesting film shot with locals in the Carolinas back in 1927. It was pretty good.
So just like a couple of years back then?
You mean 86 years ago?
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Depends on how old you are then, you know. Yeah,
back in the 1927, apparently the men were sitting around while the women did all the work. Today, happily, that's different. But people sitting around today listening to our podcast, what would they be hearing about?
Well, on today's show, we're going to find out how record labels are co-opting YouTube and how those record labels are using YouTube to promote new releases. Dawn C. Chmielewski from the Los Angeles Times will be here a little later on, and she's going to tell us all about how the music business is finally learning to play nice with one of the largest websites in the world, as it uses this video sharing service, YouTube, to its advantage. Now, television networks are also learning how to love technology and play nice with technology, specifically DVRs, and we've talked about this in the past. The time-shifting devices are helping boost the ratings for a number of this season's new series, but here's the question. Are they really boosting numbers for series that aren't being watched? We'll explain. We also have some additional information on what happened behind the scenes on the 50 Shades of Grey movie and why Charlie Hunnam, or Hunnam, I don't know how you pronounce his name properly, but why he dropped out. In China, well, there's always something going on in China, but this time it's in publishing. Stick around to find out exactly what. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about the weekend box office around the world. The number one film, no surprise, for the third week in a row is Gravity, starring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. $64 million worldwide. It's at $284 million and shows no stopping at all. This movie is a huge, huge hit, making tons of money in IMAX, tons of money in 3D, a big hit for every age, all over the world. It's a four-quadrant hit. Isn't that what Hollywood loves?
Yes, and I believe last week you called it a phenomena, and I would have to agree at this Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zero show, I heard all sorts of age ranges talking about this particular movie, just eavesdropping on their conversations. Not that I do that a lot, but, you know, we're sitting in a crowd full of 2,000 people, you hear a few conversations, and on numerous occasions, I heard people talking about Gravity.
It's so successful now that its chances of winning the Oscar are dimming.
That's true.
Because they love a big hit, but they don't like a hit that's too big.
They feel like you've already won the award. Hey, you made $1 billion. Congratulations, you win.
A much more modestly successful film, but still a big hit, is Captain Phillips, another $26 million. It's at $62 million worldwide. Tom Hanks is certainly going to be one of the frontrunner nominees for Best Actor in that film. It's certainly a success story. It cost about $55 million to make, which does not include all the money Tom Hanks will be taking home, but made on a dime, so they say, and already, you know, it looks like it's going to be well into profitability. At number three is Escape Plan, a movie that pairs Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone. Apparently, no one was waiting for it, but it made $19 million. It's at $23 million worldwide. It opened a little bit overseas, a little bit earlier. So it's at $23 million to start. Pretty soft opening in North America. Received rather indifferently, much like Carrie, a remake of the horror classic from the 70s. That made $17 million in North America. It kept falling in its tracking. People thought it'll make $30 million on opening weekend. Then they thought maybe $20 million, maybe $18 to $20 million. It ended up at $17 million, and the studio's putting a good face on it. It didn't cost a lot to make, but this is not going to be a big success.
What you're saying is, unfortunately, the face is full of blood.
That does tend to turn people off a bit. And number five around the world is Turbo, the little film from DreamWorks Animation, another $16 million. That's the most money it's made in a week in a while. It's at $226 million worldwide, and there's more to talk about it down the road, isn't there?
Yes, indeed. For instance, I don't know, ancillary maybe?
Well, yes, but also television, right?
Well, that's ancillary revenue, yes.
Oh, I would have thought ancillary meant like, you know, DVDs or whatever. But I mean, they're turning it into a TV series.
That's right. And, you know, it's DreamWorks Animation, I should say. And I know how much you appreciated that Jeffrey Katzenberg and DreamWorks Animation moved most of their animation production from the United States over to China for Kung Fu Panda. So you'll really appreciate the fact that when they're going to be making all of these Netflix TV shows or these Netflix series, that for Turbo, they decided to bring the animation production back to Korea.
Back to Korea? Well, they're saying they're going to be making TV shows in every corner of the world.
That's right.
And one of the big ones is South Korea. This is not news. In television, animated shows have been done overseas almost inevitably, except for South Park. Virtually every animated show is actually rendered overseas. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I mean, back in the early 90s, I went on an interview for a position at Film Roman, which was the group that made The Simpsons, that animated The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'll be an executive in this company. And then I said, all right, yeah, let's go see all the animators. And they were like, well, there's one right there. And I thought, oh, great. Where are all the others? They're like, no, that's the one that we have here. And they do what's called, they do all of the in-between.
Interstitial?
No, they do the key frames of animation here in the U.S. and then they send it to South Korea and for what's called the in-betweens for all of the different, the movement, basically. Mm-hmm.
So you got him and then you turn to the wife and then they fill in all the movement in between.
Exactly.
Right. Well, so that show is being produced in South Korea. Not a surprise for shows in general being done overseas. But in this case, Turbo was a big hit in South Korea. That was one of the territories where it really has done well. So that also makes a little bit more sense. South Korea, of course, has been punching above its weight in a lot of categories for quite a few years. It's been a real force culturally in Asia as far as movies and pop music and television shows. Those are watched and copied all over the region. And you can see it's also been a force in animation, and now that's perhaps growing as well. At number six, another animated film, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, another $15 million. It's at $124 million worldwide. Now, in a movie we haven't talked about in a little while, it's the Wolverine sequel, The Wolverine, starring Hugh Jackman. I guess it opened in China or Japan. I don't know where it opened, but it made $13 million. So it's now at $390 million and counting.
Which would explain why they keep making those movies, because it's at $390 million and counting.
That's right. How much did it cost to make? I think The Wolverine was like $120 million, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember, but I believe it's approaching, you know, well over doubling, perhaps tripling its budget. So that's, you know, that's a good box office. It cost $115 million to make. So that's, you know, it's almost tripled its budget.
Now, let me get this straight. The last movie was called Wolverine, and then the sequel, they added
The.
So it's The Wolverine.
Makes all the difference in the world.
Yes, indeed. Apparently about $100 million worth of difference.
At number eight is Special ID. This is a Chinese action film about undercover cops who are being exposed one by one. It grossed $12.5 million. It opened in eight territories. And number nine is that Russian film we spoke about, the 3D IMAX movie Stalingrad, an epic period piece. It made another $12 million. It's at $36 million. And number 10, the Hugh Jackman again with Jake Gyllenhaal in Prisoners. Another $9 million. That's getting closer and closer to $100 million worldwide. At number 11, Insidious Chapter 2, the horror flick, made another $8 million. That's $128 million. Despicable Me 2 is hitting $900 million, just a few pennies away. Runner Runner is the Ben Affleck and Justin Timberlake movie, another $5.8 million. It's now getting close to doubling its budget of $30 million. It's at $55 million. Before all is said and done, it will certainly pass $60 million. And then there's the Richard Curtis film, or Richard Curtis. How do you say his name?
Richard Curtis, I thought.
Richard Curtis, the British director. About Time, his romantic film, his specialty. That's made another $5.5 million overseas. That's a $24 million and counting.
And then you have a film that nobody is seeing, Rush. It's made $70 million to date worldwide. And I think, I was talking to a studio executive over the weekend who said, we're really surprised about this because it's actually a decent film. And we thought it would do a lot better, not only in North America, but overseas as well.
Yeah, you know, Ron Howard, as I look at his track record, he's very spotty commercially, actually. You know, he has lots of ups and downs. I guess to his credit, you could say he makes risky movies. This, you know, his films all seem very safe and middle of the road. But as far as subject matter or whatever, this is about Formula One racing. People are like, oh, my God, no one wants to see a movie about Formula One. They don't know what it is. To me, it's a racing movie. It seems pretty simple, but it was two not big names in the roles of the leads and, has not done that well. But what really scares people is not a movie like Rush, where they made it for $38 million and it's doing sort of okay around the world. What really scares studios is something like The Fifth Estate, which opened in North America on about 1,800 screens. This is the movie about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch, a rising star who's a big name in the UK. It grossed $1.7 million in North America. It grossed less than $1,000 per screen. This is one of those movies where people just ran in the other direction. Long before the movie came out, nobody wanted to see it.
That is very true. And I can tell you, having spoken to some of the folks at DreamWorks, they now believe they will lose between $5 and $6 million on this because they've mitigated their risk by, of course, selling all of the rights for overseas. So yeah, I think the movie cost $30 million to make. And they only had about five or six into it on their own.
Right. It's just scary, though. It has an Oscar-winning director. Well, not Oscar-winning director, but a director of Oscar-winning films, Bill Condon.
That's right.
No, he won for screenplay. He won for screenplay, didn't he?
I think so.
Of Gods and Monsters. So he won for that. So Bill Condon, an established director, made Oscar-winning films, a hot potential product, very classic Oscar bait type movie. You do put all the elements in place, and yet somehow it's not that it doesn't work. It's that it's not even remotely working. It's kind of like the art house version of The Lone Ranger, where everybody just completely said, no, we have no interest whatsoever. And I think that scares Hollywood more than anything, you know, where it's just, you can't even get out of the starting gate.
Well, there's a couple things that are difficult about this particular film, Fifth Estate, not the least of which is a lot of it takes place with people sitting at computers typing.
Oh, well, it's not a well-reviewed movie, so it's not a good movie. That never helps.
Of course, that never helps. Absolutely.
I mean, it doesn't stop a movie from being successful, but it doesn't help.
That's right, because of course The Social Network could have been, you know, construed
right,
as the same thing.
Idea.
Yeah, but absolutely. This has far more of it, and the performances are great. It's not a horrible movie. It's just not a great movie, and it needed to be a great movie. Now, something struck me when I went to see this movie over the weekend, and I went to...
You're the guy who went.
Yes, I'm the one guy. I was responsible for all $1.7 million. A couple things. I've been to the theater now for 2 weeks in a row, the multiplex, and different multiplexes in a very large urban area. Now, this is a very anecdotal, some anecdotal evidence in a very narrow geographical area, but in both instances, from the lobby to the box office to the theater itself inside the auditorium, I personally lowered the average age of those attending.
Oh, what was it, the middle of the day, during the week?
No, it was evening. Each time it was evening. The Fifth Estate, I was like, well, this movie's not going to do well. There's a row of senior citizens here.
Well, that, you know, right now, you look at the big movies in the box office right now, they are for adults. Gravity, Captain Phillips, 12 Years a Slave and Limited Release, The Fifth Estate. These are not movies, you know, the movies that are going to attract younger people are not out right now. Escape Plan, Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, they're, you know, on the cover of AARP magazine to promote it. So there's no movie for anybody under 50 right now. I mean, there's a movie for people who like good movies. Gravity is appealing to everyone, but you can see why it's a slow period. It's October. We haven't quite picked up yet. We haven't hit the holiday season of November and December. That's where I think you'll see audiences coming out again, families in full force. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, that's had the family frame to itself for quite a few weeks now.
Yes, you know what? The reason I mention all of this is, it really made me, there was this weird feeling that came over me standing in line at the box office and in the lobby. And then once I sat down, I thought, when have I felt like this before? In what cultural event? And I thought, wait a second, the opera. And when I go to see a play where I feel like I'm the youngest person in the room.
Yeah. Well, yeah, plays are a whole new story. The average age there really is like 70.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I mean, they actually, every play I've seen now, they remind patrons that if your hearing aid is buzzing, please, you know, it's.
Well, you have to, yeah, because it makes a horrible noise.
That's
so
right.
Opening and limited release was, in fact, 12 Years a Slave, along with the Robert Redford C film All Is Lost and Daniel Radcliffe getting all beatniky in Kill Your Darlings. The big winner was, of course, 12 Years a Slave. It opened on 19 screens and made $50,000 per screen. A good, strong average to start off. Its march to the Oscars has begun.
Well, and who did you say was in All Is Lost? Robert C. Redford?
Robert Redford's C film.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I thought I said that. That's where he's lost alone at sea in a boat all alone and barely says anything other than, damn it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's very true. And he really looks his age there. I mean, it's a fairly decent film. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it yet. Those are the movies that are playing at the box office. But for movies that aren't coming to the box office yet, we can talk about 50 Shades of Grey. I think this is fascinating. It's sort of a backstory about how a deal fell apart or how an actor backed out of a movie and why.
Well, so 50 Shades of Grey, of course, is this hit.
Spanky, spanky.
I don't know necessarily what that even means, never having read the novels. But it's, you know, a best-selling novel, and Focus Features and Universal Pictures, they come in, swoop up, and they take the film rights, and they're going to turn it into a film along with, the, you know, I guess there's three novels, so they're going to make a trilogy out of it. And it becomes like this big, like, who's going to play the main characters, the woman, the man in this? Like,
big casting news.
Yeah, and so Dakota Johnson is going to play the 24-year-old...
college student.
Yeah, the virgin to sex expert or whatever they referred to her as. And then Charlie Hunnam was cast as the billionaire, the older billionaire.
Yeah, he's like 24 in the books. He's not that much older.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, but in the end, Charlie Hunnam said, wow, no, I'm not going to do this.
Well, I mean, it's just 5 weeks before the movie was to begin shooting. It was big news. I mean, I haven't seen this much attention paid to casting in quite a while. There was a lot of feverish speculation, and it got a good mainstream play when they announced who the stars would be. People are really interested in this. So he backed out, not just as the deal was being made, but just a few weeks before shooting was set to begin. So that's pretty significant.
Well, and you can see how quickly they're moving, because this was a big novel, a best-selling novel last year. They picked it up. They already have a release date. I think it's sometime in May 2014. So they are just running and gunning, getting this thing into production. They're not waiting at all. And so they announced that Charlie Hunnam was going to star in this movie just a couple months ago, and they're already shooting starting in the first week of November. I think
it's one of those phenomenons that you want to get it out as soon as possible.
I couldn't agree more.
It ain't gone with the wind.
I think that the last time there was casting news like this was probably for the Hunger Games.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true. And that was very successful. But why did he back out? What happened?
Well, apparently, according to his camp, he kind of freaked out over all the attention that he was getting, because this was a big casting news and all of these, the media was
saying, isn't that way? Don't stars love attention?
Yes. But then, you know, they had to get him, you know, Universal had to hire bodyguards for him to go to certain premieres. He stars in the Sons of Anarchy, and there was a premiere for this season's episodes. And he had to have bodyguards escort him there. There were other events that were canceled because of the frenzy around him. And he was a little uncomfortable with that. But then he also was like, you know, I'm kind of a screenwriter. I've got a pen. Heck, I've even got a typewriter. You know what? I might get me one of those word processors. I'm going
to
actually...
To be fair, he has had a script optioned by Brad Pitt's production company. He has a horror script called Vlad that Brad Pitt actually optioned for to make into a film.
Yes, but that does not do me any good with this joke at all.
I'm sorry. So what happened? He says he's a scriptwriter. What did he gave notes on the film or?
Yeah, he gave he had 50 some odd notes on 50 Shades of Grey. Get it? And so he gave all these notes and actually the studio went, huh, yeah, actually some of these are pretty good. And so the creative team behind the film said, all right, let's incorporate some of these notes. And they had the scriptwriter incorporate some of the notes. They hired another scriptwriter recently to do a polish and punch up the Patrick Marber to do a rewrite.
That's right. He's an acclaimed playwright. I guess he wanted the money. Right. Not sure why else he'd be doing it.
Well, because it pays quite a lot when you do these rewrites like that.
Perhaps more than the actors, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. Yes. And by the way, I would not be surprised if as a rewrite man, as a ghostwriter here, Patrick Marber made upwards of $100,000 per week to do the punch up of the characters. Now, that said, it probably only lasted 1 or 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Still, that's $200,000.
But here's the fascinating thing I found. This detail in The Hollywood Reporter about how this deal fell through, why he backed out of the movie. They talked about his team, the people at CAA and Brillstein Entertainment Partners. All of them were getting together as Charlie Hunnam was getting cold feet. And they said, no, no, no. They strongly advised, that's a quote, that he would stay on the project after he began butting heads with the creative team on the film. Why? Did they tell him, oh, no, it's going to be a huge movie. It's going to make you a movie star. Did they say, oh, it's going to bring out a sexy new angle, give you better, more interesting parts? Did they see it was going to, you know, be a big commercial hit? No, they said they were worried that if he backed out, it would embarrass the new head of Universal Pictures, Donna Langley.
Now, you, I don't know. I mean, we had a kind
I'm
of
fixated on this.
Yes, I know. We kind of talked about this during our pre-show warm-up here and conversation before we started recording. Now, you thought that, hey, CAA and Brillstein Entertainment, one is a huge management company, and that's Brillstein Entertainment. The other is the largest talent agency in the world, and that's Creative Artists Agency.
And if I'm an actor, I want to hear reasons about why it's good or bad for me. I don't give a damn if it embarrasses the head of the studio. I'm not going to make a movie because if I back out, it might embarrass them.
Now,
you know, give
now,
them a little
you
discomfort.
Thought, you thought that the talent representative.
I'm outraged. I would be like, I'd be firing everybody. I'm like, you don't have my best interest at heart. You're not talking about me. You're talking about her. You don't work for Donna Langley. You work with me. I'm paying you. Why am I hearing about what's good for somebody else?
The way I took this was, hey, you're an actor. You're going to need to work with studios. It's probably a bad idea to embarrass and piss off one of these six studios you're going to have to work for if you want to star in movies. So,
well, nobody would take it lightly, but that's not a reason to not make a movie. You don't make a movie because in the future you might want to make another movie with them, and therefore you should make this movie you have huge reservations about.
Well, I think it's certainly this is a film somewhat short-sighted.
That if it blows up in your face, as it could really tarnish your career, bring it to a dead halt.
That's
it's
right.
It's a film about bondage and spanking, and it is just a huge risk. It's like 9.5 weeks. Mickey Rourke never really recovered from 9.5 weeks, or it took him a long, long time. You know,
yeah, like 30 years, and I don't think he ever did recover.
That movie made money, but it turned him into a joke.
Mickey Rourke had a lot of help from himself on that.
That's true, but nonetheless, you, I think you appreciate with me that it is a big risk.
Yes, oh, absolutely, absolutely, and that's really what his camp should be saying. I mean, let's face it, Creative Artists Agency. If they piss Donna Langley off, yes, it's a mark on them, but they don't care because they've got Tom Cruise and Jennifer Lawrence. Donna Langley is going to work with Creative Artists Agency and Brillstein Entertainment in the future, whether this happened or not. For Charlie Hunnam, I think he could easily go star in a few other films, and if they do well, certainly yeah. Donna Langley is going to come back and
not gonna hold a grudge.
Right. And I have actually seen heads of studios, a woman head of a studio who referred to former A-list actor who still is starring in movies today as so ugly, who would ever want to sleep with that particular person? And this was in the early 1990s. They couldn't believe this person was a star. Well, guess what? That same studio executive was the keynote speaker when that movie star received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
But I know that for you, also, a big deal was how much Charlie Hunnam was reportedly meant to be paid for this.
They said Charlie Hunnam was going to be paid $125,000 to make this movie. And I thought that was like they dropped a zero. I mean, that is astonishing to me that he could be offered so little on his basic contract. I just can't believe it.
Well, and we went back and forth again before the show about how that could possibly be.
You're explaining to me that that people don't get, obviously an actor like his stature would not get gross points on a film, but you're saying he's going to have something in his contract that at every stage where the movie hits 50 million, 100 million, 150 million, whatever, he's going to get more money.
That's right. And they call them performance bumps. Now, I'm not saying he couldn't get points, especially the way contracts.
No, he's not getting points.
Just let me finish. The way contracts are negotiated today with all of these, hey, we're going to make this on a dime. And hey, if it does well, we'll all do well kind of, let's all be in on the risk. Of course, then go and try and collect afterwards. Performance bumps are almost guaranteed because it's a one-time payment and the unions get involved. These gross points or even net points or profit participation, as they now call it, it's a little bit riskier because you then have to go and audit the books of the studio if you really want to get everything you're owed. But
so the way this would work is that not the studio coming to you and saying, all right, we've now reached this level, but simply once it's in the press, according to like RentTrack, which is where we get our worldwide figures, once RentTrack says 50 Shades of Grey hits $100 million North America, then you get X amount of dollars.
That's right. And you could easily earn $500,000 by doing that. But of course,
Could be any money.
Right. The studio is kind of mitigating their risk by saying, look, if it never reaches that, hey, at least we didn't pay you $5 million to star in this thing.
So this is how you're saying Gravity has an announced budget of $100 million. Captain Phillips says it costs $55 million. Prisoners cost $46 million. The Fifth Estate costs $28 million. Rush costs $38 million, even though it's made by Ron Howard, who's a big, powerful director. This is how all these movies are naming these low budgets, because a lot of the actors involved in these movies are going to take a piece of the pie automatically once it hits a certain amount of success.
Yes. Now, what I'm waiting for now, of course, Flight last year with Denzel Washington and Robert Zemeckis directing. I mean, Robert Zemeckis said, look, I understood that we could not make this movie for $150 million. Denzel Washington understood that he's not yes, he's an A-list movie star, but the way things are going.
Denzel Washington is money in the bank. Denzel Washington is one of the most.
Why do you think he's betting on himself there? He's saying, I know that people are going to come to this movie. And so I will be more than happy to take a lower fee up front for a larger fee in the back end. And that's exactly what happened for him.
And that movie grossed $160 million worldwide. The budget was reportedly $31 million.
Right. And they basically
tripled that in North America alone, where it made $93 million.
And Zemeckis said at the time, he was very upfront about lowering the cost of making this film, which everybody thought was risky and none of the studios wanted to touch it. He said, well, what if we can do it on a dime? And that's the way that movie was made. Now, what I'm waiting for is for all of the talent representatives and the talent themselves to say, okay, we'll do this. However, you have to guarantee that you're going to market it a certain way, or you're going to put a certain amount of resources behind marketing it.
Which is what happened with Don John.
That's right.
That's the Joseph Gordon-Levitt film that he cost $6 million to make. He sold it to a certain studio and said they had to commit to like a $25 million print and advertising budget so that it would get a serious push.
Right. Now, this may already be happening. They may be saying, the studios that is, saying, okay, we're going to commit to a certain marketing campaign. However, we're going to do it in stages. And if at any point we just see this is throwing good money after bad, we're going to start backing off of that. So it has to hit certain levels for them to continue the marketing push.
They guarantee to spend this much at launch, and they guarantee to spend more on second and third week, assuming that the launch isn't a disaster. Is that the idea?
It's just like when Prince, years and years ago in the early 90s, signed a $100 million recording contract. Well, yes, he did, but it was dependent upon, you know, the first $10 million was guaranteed. The next record had to, you know, the first record had to reach a certain level for him to make another $10 million for the second record.
So, but none of it matters. None of it matters beyond opening weekend, because if it's a big success, they're going to spend the money no matter what. And if it's a flop, they're not going to spend it no matter what.
Precisely.
So all that really matters is what they guarantee to do to launch it.
That's right.
Right. So, you know, there you go. So that's how you make movies on a dime. One movie that costs a little bit more than a dime, of course, is Noah, the Darren Aronofsky Bible epic starring Russell Crowe, which is by far the biggest film he's ever made. It's his biggest film since The Fountain, the last time he tried to make a big studio film.
And when you say he, you mean Darren Aronofsky, the director who is also responsible for such huge, giant effects-driven movies like The Wrestler, Pi, and Requiem for a Dream.
And The Fighter and Black Swan. Black Swan, of course, is his biggest commercial hit by far. That dwarfs everything else he's done, including the Oscar-winning The Fighter.
Wait, The Fighter? Yeah. No. The Fighter? The one with Mark Wahlberg and Christian Bale? That was David O. Russell.
He was just executive producer. I beg your pardon. So okay. His last big movie was The Swan, Black Swan, which dwarfed everything else he's ever made. It was made
$329 million, I think.
Yeah. The next closest movie is The Wrestler, which made $46 million, starring our friend Mickey Rourke, right?
Yes, that's right. our new friend who loves us now, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think he's a talented actor who got sidestepped by a big pop cultural hit.
And apparently a lot of plastic surgeons.
Yeah, that's right. So this movie is huge, huge film compared to everything else he's ever done. They've done some test screenings around Hollywood and everyone's talking about it because it's not going well.
Yeah, they're not talking about it in a good way. So now, you know, Darren Aronofsky, who is an auteur, if you will, is saying, hey, I get final cut, baby. I don't care what you think of my movie. I'm going to make it the way I want to make it. And they said, you know, that works, actually, on a $20 million movie. But let's talk about the $150 million we spent producing this one and the $150 million we're going to have to spend to market it.
I love this. They had a screening in New York for mostly Jewish audiences. They had a screening in Arizona for mostly Christians. And then they went to Orange County, California for just regular Joes. And none of the screenings went well.
Right.
I mean, you would hope at least maybe the Jews will like it. Maybe the Christians will like it. Maybe the atheists will like it. Nobody liked it. So they're having trouble figuring out the movie. They have several different cuts. They can't figure out what to do. A bizarre thing that they talked about in the Hollywood Reporter, it's been a challenge to come up with an exciting third act. It's like, well, the movie's been shot, so there's nothing to come up with anymore. It's just how you cut it. But there's no, the third act is the movie ends when they hit land again, right? Are they going to create some new drama after they land?
I don't know. I mean, I think they're rewriting.
There's a big storm, and then you're saved, and you get to go back and start rebuilding. That's the end of the movie, isn't it? I don't know what else they would do. Would there be attacks? Would there be a war?
I don't know. Hold on a second. I'm making a note to myself. Hire Patrick Marber to rewrite Bible. Okay. I have no idea.
It's called Noah. Yeah. And this is, you know, a big studio release. I'm sure Russell Crowe has points in one way or another, performance guarantees, who knows what. But still, it's a big budget movie, by far his biggest ever. There are no animals in it. That's how high tech this movie is. It's a movie about Noah and the Ark with animals, and there are no animals in the film. No real live animals.
Aronofsky said to DGA Quarterly, which is a magazine for the Directors Union, that Industrial Light and Magic told him that rendering all of the animals was the most complicated job they've ever taken on in the history of their company.
No animals. What are they thinking?
They're all
going to be digitally created?
Well, in all fairness, when Steven Spielberg made Jurassic Park, there were no dinosaurs, in all fairness.
You make a good point.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think that when you try and market a film for the Christian audience and the Jewish audience and of course, general public, you're marketing to everybody. And when you market to everybody, the old saying goes, you're actually marketing to nobody.
Well, but if you create an ad to go on national television, isn't that an ad for everybody?
That's the ad for, well, not really, no. When you create an ad for
national... An ad for kids, an ad for adults.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the ad for Noah should be an exciting, fun film with this epic tale of a massive worldwide storm and surviving it.
Well, frankly, I would just make the ad for Noah just like one word and maybe like the release date underneath. So that way when people are fast forwarding past it with their DVRs, they can just, that must be the film Noah, that Darren Aronofsky film. And oh, look, it's coming out March 14th.
That's right. People are now creating ads to be seen on your DVR. And because that's how a lot of people are watching their television.
You mean they now are. You just said they're not doing that, but I think they are.
They now are.
Okay.
Yeah. They're creating ads that have sort of static images or big visuals that you can catch even when you're fast forwarding through an ad that stops you or catches your eye, at least lets you know what product they were advertising, because that's how a lot of people watch TV. The new fall television season has begun. It used to be shows would live or die in like 2 minutes. It would air, and by the next morning, you'd say, it's a disaster. Now it takes like 2 weeks before you find out what's going on.
I mean, it used to be, I think, that some shows were canceled before the second act break. Like in that first commercial break, they called up the actors and said, don't come in tomorrow.
Exactly. Now what's happening? It's new fall season. Everybody's having success.
Well, you remember last year, I think it was October 29th, episode 169 of Showbiz Sandbox. I think the title of that episode
like you
was,
didn't look that up?
I did, actually.
I think it was.
Yeah. Scott Collins wrote a story for the Los Angeles Times, and I think we had him on the show, and we titled the show How Television Networks Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the DVR. Well, a year later, they're really loving the DVR because I guess they're seeing all of their audiences skyrocket from DVR numbers.
Well, because there's more people with DVRs than ever before. There's more channels than ever before. There's more often where there's one or two or different shows on at the same time and you want to sample one or you're not at home. You just use your DVR all the time like I do. So naturally, people watch it live and then a lot of other people tune in the next night or later that night or the next day or 3 days later and then they catch up on the show.
That's right.
You're finding is not that there's any show that nobody wants to watch live, but they all watch it on DVR. It's not like a show is a flop and then suddenly 8 million people watch it on DVR. That doesn't happen. Basically, it reflects the popularity of your show. Sometimes if there's a really tight time slot and you've got three really popular shows, maybe one of them will get a big advantage in the DVR that it would otherwise lack. But basically, if you're a big hit, you're going to add that many more people on DVR.
Yeah.
So The Blacklist is a big hit for NBC, and it's one of the biggest successes when it comes to adding in 4 to 5 million viewers via DVR.
Right. In other words, when people want to watch your show, they want to watch your show, whether it's live or in DVR. If people don't want to watch your show, they really don't care, and they're not going to watch your show.
That's right. So shows like Robin Williams and The Crazy Ones, The Marvels, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Sleepy Hollow on Fox, though I don't know why. These shows are all turning to hits, and they're all also benefiting significantly from their DVR numbers.
That's right. And it can take, get this, 11 days to finally get all the numbers in.
Which, and that doesn't even include like online streaming and other stuff, does it?
No, I don't believe so.
No, it doesn't. We're just talking about how many people watch the show and how many people watched it within 24 hours via DVR, how many people watched it in 3 days, and then how many people watched it in 7 days. Of course it takes 11 days because they've got 7 days to watch it.
Yeah, well, you know, I DVR just about everything, including sports. I can DVR sports. In fact, I'm a little backlogged right now. I'm still on game 3 of the National League Championship Series between the Dodgers and the Cardinals. Don't tell me how it ends.
It's a nail biter.
Oh, whew, thank goodness.
What you do find is that shows are now hitting series highs in ways they never did before. It used to be a show would peak after 3 or 4 years and then settle back down again. You know, it'd go up into a peak and then slowly slide back down again. Sometimes show was maintained sort of the level all along. What you didn't see was a show 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years into their run getting more and more viewers. Law and Order is one of the rare examples to disprove that, which is why people talked about it so much. And the reasons were it went into syndication, it was out on DVD, all these reasons why they thought that show would gain audiences that far into a run. Nowadays, shows seem to grow every year until they're done. Like Breaking Bad, that show grew every year, every season, more and more people. Walking Dead, same thing. American Horror Story, the new season Coven, biggest ratings ever, 5.5 million people in its first broadcast for the third season. And that's just what's happening now. Scandal, it's growing its third year. It's still growing. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Obviously, DVRs, people being able to catch up on DVD and Blu-ray or streaming video. But for me, the big reason is their ratings are so low to begin with.
So what you're saying, and this is my big joke for this segment, is in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Okay. Right. Like Breaking Bad had like 800,000 people or a million. Then it had 1.5 million, then 2 million, then 3 million. Well, there's a lot of room to grow when you're getting all that press, all that attention, all that acclaim, and you've been around 5, 6 years. Clearly, there's a lot of pent-up demand to see your show. If you can keep bringing people in and they can do it via DVR and DVDs and streaming, then they have a chance to join the conversation. And that's why the final half season opened with 6 million people because You know, they weren't around there. I mean, that's just nothing for a major network. You wouldn't even be in the top 50 if you were on a major network. But for Breaking Bad, that was a record high. And they could say every year was bigger than the year before. And one of the big reasons is their ratings were so low to begin with. So,
well, you know, this effect was also felt in movies in the early 2000s, the early aughts, if you will, when, or maybe it was 1999, when Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, I think was the second one. And it opened. Its opening box office, if I recall correctly, was $54 million, which was the amount of money theatrically the first Austin Powers movie made. And everybody thought, how the heck did that happen? How did even people even know that that movie existed? Well, it was because of the DVD. It had done so well on DVD that the opening weekend for the second film just skyrocketed.
Right. I think one of the earlier examples of that was Die Hard.
Well, yes.
Where the first movie, you know, same thing. It exploded when Die Hard 2 came out. Suddenly, a movie that had done well became a monster franchise because it had done really well on VCR and DVD. It was no DVDs back then, but people caught up on it on VHS. And suddenly, a movie that was modest became a big franchise, and they'd stay bigger. And that was different too. It used to be a movie was a big hit or whatever it made. If it made a sequel, it would make about 2/3 of that. And then the sequel to that would make 2/3 of that. So they'd cost more to make less money, but it all worked out in the end. Nowadays, the sequel can double the budget, triple the budget. You know, there's no, the rules are out the window.
Well, you know, speaking of rules, I guess there's two ways to go with that. We could talk about the NFL being on Netflix or Google TV, or we could, well, it's not called Google TV anymore. It's called Chromecast, but, or
I've never heard of it. What's Google TV?
Well, there you go. That's why they're changing the name. Or we could talk about how some shows actually stay on a little bit past their prime, like Glee.
Well, always. Oh, that happens all the time. If a show has any success, Glee was clearly a quick pop cultural phenomenon like 50 Shades of Grey. It's already well past its due date. Now, you know, they renewed it for two more seasons when people didn't really even want to see it this season. And now they've announced, yeah. Next year will be Glee's last. It's a well long overdue. They can prepare for it in advance. Frankly, this season should be their last. I'm surprised they didn't pull the plug and change their minds on that two-season renewal.
Yeah, good point. Well, so then let's talk about the NFL being on one of these, I don't know what, SVOD, subscription video on demand, Netflix and Google both in the mix there, talking to the NFL, the league, if you will, American football, about maybe, you know, you're going to expand Thursday play. You're going to, most of these games are on Sunday. There's one on Monday night, and one on Thursday night. And the league is saying, well, maybe we can have two on Thursday night, two games on Thursday. And Netflix and Google are talking to them about possibly being the folks that distribute that.
Well, Netflix says they're not interested, right?
Well, they say we're absolutely 100% not interested unless it's a really good idea.
But we'll talk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
right, well, it's inevitable. It will happen. Sports is going online. Bull riding, which I follow, which nobody else does, but that is now available on YouTube rather than on NBC Sports Channel. So that's on YouTube. They have, people were watching so many bull rides. It was like, you know, bull riding lasts 8 seconds. So a lot of people would go online and watch quick videos of their favorite bull riders and see their ride for that week, their three rides, their five rides, whatever it might be, because it's perfect encapsulated moment on YouTube. You know, it's short, it's quick. You see the whole thing and then you're done.
I don't know. You know, when I go to my local bar, it seems like the folks on those mechanical bulls, they're on there way longer than 8 seconds.
Nice. So that was a natural migration to YouTube. And it's just inevitable that when there's money to be made, that the NFL wants to encourage more buyers. Netflix and Google and all these people want to reach viewers. And football is where it's at. Sunday Night Football on NBC. This Sunday night was the Broncos versus the Colts. The Colts? The Colts on October 20th.
Don't tell me who won. I have it on DVR. No, actually, tell me who won.
The Colts beat the Broncos 39-33. Oh. It was the fourth highest rating ever for the series. The highest October rating for primetime football since 1998.
Wow.
26 million people. That does not include +3 or +7, because I do watch a lot of sports on DVR.
You mean +3 days or +7 days?
Right, which I do with baseball. Normally, people watch it later that night on DVR. They don't usually wait a lot of days for sports. But they do wait till later that night, so that will be included in the +3. And, you know, that's a huge number of people. That's where the eyeballs are. So if Netflix wants to reach people, football is a great way to do it.
Well, Netflix is, of course, into this original content game now quite heavily, and so much so that it looks like some of the major studios, the major production companies, are beginning to turn to them not as an alternative to produce shows that maybe the big networks didn't want to pick up, but instead of them.
Right. I didn't get the import of this, but you explained it to me. Because obviously for a couple of years now, big players, big talent, big people like Kevin Spacey have been making original programming for online sites like Netflix.
But these are like independent.
That seemed to be news. But this is actually news. The creators of Damages are bringing their new series to Netflix. I'm like, well, okay, that's been happening for a little while now. Why is this different?
Well, because Kevin Spacey's production company is an independent production company. They're not a big giant studio and a part of a big giant conglomerate. In this case, Damages is actually being backed by Sony.
No, the creators of Damages. It's a new series from the creators of Damages.
Oh, okay. My mistake.
It's not called Damages. That's the show that they created that was a big hit.
Yes.
The Glenn Close
series. I'm misreading this. Todd Kessler, Daniel Zellman, and Glenn Kessler, they are doing this show through Sony Pictures Television. Now, Sony Pictures Television normally would go to NBC, ABC, CBS, or some of the big cable networks. In this case, they said, yeah, thanks, but we're going to go to a different buyer that we know of. We want to sell the first 13 episodes, the first season, to SVOD, to Netflix.
So they've attracted major talent, and now they're attracting the major players who create content.
That's
the big
right.
players who put their shows in on the big networks and the top cable channels. Now they consider Netflix on par with them. They're doing business with them. They're bringing their shows to them, and they're making deals.
Right. And now HBO is saying to, of course, the broadcast and cable networks, hey, welcome to the club, guys. You know, we've been competing with Netflix for years, even when they were saying, we're not the competitors to HBO. We're like friendly enemies. We're friends. And we kept saying, hey, they keep taking all of our content. So they are competing with us. And now guess what? They're competing with you, too.
Well, and the creative community is happy, right? I mean, the Sony Pictures Television is glad to have another buyer with credibility and a paycheck. You know, a big bank account that they can back their shows, right?
Well, and an audience. So it's not like, well, we took the money for the first 13 episodes, but then nobody watched it. We never got to make another 13.
Well,
no,
we don't know what the audience is yet. We haven't gotten figures on that. We don't know how many people watched House of Cards.
That's true.
We have no idea how popular Orange is the New Black may be. That's a Lionsgate series that is also on Netflix.
That's right. And so I know that there's some people that would say, well, Lionsgate's a big studio. They're not as big as Sony Pictures Television. So this is a big major television production company.
It's another sign of the times.
Yes, another sign of the times, indeed.
And of course, it's October, which means another sign of the times is that the announcement of the people eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the shortlist.
Are they really people, or are they artists or musicians or bands?
Artists and musicians are people too.
Okay.
So these are this is the long list or the short, what do we call this? I guess we call it the long list. These are the nominees for the 2014 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. So we got about 12 people here, and out of them, all the members will vote. Fans get to voice their approval and get a group vote on one ballot. So there's thousands of people who vote in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then fans all over the country, they vote, and their top five picks become one single ballot as well. So they have a tiny, tiny – they can't influence the outcome, but they get to have a voice, and we hear what the fans want, and we get to find out who the big winners will be for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who's going to make the cut and get into the hall.
Now, we're going to list all of these people, and we're going to play a song from each to make our show even shorter. So, the Paul Butterfield
Shouldn't we just do an a cappella rendition of it?
You go first.
Okay.
Michael, I know you know the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. You have to. It's
Nice Jewish Boys Who Played the Blues. That's their, okay. They're an influential group. They're just not very good. I don't think they deserve to be in the hall.
Chic, Nile Rodgers' old group.
Well, yeah, they're disco legends. Le Freak, they did some great songs. Incredibly influential as a producer. I would say if Nile Rodgers could be inducted as a producer in one of those side categories, you know, not as an artist, but as a producer and songwriter, they would deserve it. I don't think Chic's body of work as such makes them eligible for the hall. Unlike,
but
say,
Donna
Summer.
And roll, so you're saying a disco legend should not be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Okay.
Well, let's get, we got hip hop, we got rock, we got country people. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is about popular music.
Okay.
So I think that's why you don't see classical and jazz and bluegrass people, though they are sometimes there as pioneers or influences. But as far as who gets into the hall, we're talking about popular music. I think we've established if it's popular music from the 50s, early 60s on, whether that's hip hop or pop, or disco, or rock and roll, you have a chance to get into the hall.
So Deep Purple, heavy metal group.
Big heavy metal band. Our friend Sal, who is a big record guy, he argues strongly for them. He says, no band before or since has incorporated the Hammond organ, classical music. They are a heavy metal, you know, pioneers. Me, I've never listened to them, but I don't know much about heavy metal.
What about Peter Gabriel?
I was astonished at the people who argued against Peter Gabriel. In fact, I had a friend who argued Phil Collins deserves to get in more than Peter Gabriel because he was such a great drummer in jazz fusion and progressive rock, and then he wrote great pop music, blah, blah, blah. I would think Peter Gabriel is a lock. I think he's very innovative as far as his record label, where he promoted world music, and he also incorporated world music into his own. Of course, his work in the progressive rock band Genesis, which I'm not a huge fan of, but that was important. And I think his solo material has a really strong integrity, you know, especially his first four or five solo albums when he broke up commercially finally with Sledgehammer and the album So. But I think leading up to that, those four albums are really the core of his work along with his world music label. I think he's an important artist and innovator in what he did in the industry. His live performances, the technology he embraced, the world music, I think all of that put together makes him eligible for the Hall.
So you're saying that the Hall isn't out of touch and that they you see where I'm going with this?
I do.
Because you can go for that.
And on my list is Hall and Oates.
Hall and Oates songs. Did you see how I did that?
They should have been on this list long ago. They seem a no-brainer to me. They were the most successful duo of all time, bigger than Simon and Garfunkel, bigger than the Everly Brothers, bigger than anybody. They're the most successful, but success does not get you into the Hall. Celine Dion will never get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But Hall and Oates, Blue Eyed Soul, they wrote, they sang, they played, ultimately they produced. I mean, they have a lot of credibility. They're terrific artists. I think their importance was long overshadowed by how successful they were, but we've all come to realize what a solid body of work they created.
I think that the reason they haven't actually been nominated before is because they still cannot say the word make. They keep pronouncing it make-a. And that's yet another reference to one of their songs. But, okay, so let's move on to Kiss here. Kiss, the rock band that for the first part of their career was in makeup and nobody knew who they were.
Well, they knew who they were, but they kept the mystery and excitement around them. I would say if there's a makeup category, maybe they should get in. Personally, I don't think so. They got a couple great songs. I think they're more power to them for having such a long career with such limited talent. But that's how I feel about Kiss.
What about LL Cool J, the actor who I don't know what he's doing on this list. He's in movies and television shows. What the heck is he doing here?
I mean, he certainly came to attention as a rap star. You know,
I know
Love
that
was his soft rap ballady song that broke him out. He had a few good tunes. Absolutely does not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Not even close.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is that the people who were making this list up,
they know him and they like him. He's been a host of the Grammys. He's been around. He's a lovable guy. He's on a hit show that gets no respect either. He's never going to win an Emmy Award for NCIS, but there you are.
Well, and he told the people making this list up that his mama said to knock them out.
Well, okay. Thank you. Stop trying.
Okay. Let's skip ahead to Nirvana.
Like, why are you skipping the meters?
Just because, you know.
We've only got 14. We've got to speed it up. But the Meters, a classic New Orleans band. They're the house band for people like all sorts of New Orleans legends. They're on a ton of albums. If there was a jazz or an R Zydeco Hall of Fame, they belong on there. Their music has been sampled a lot, but they do not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Nirvana is a lock.
Nirvana's a lock? Absolutely.
NWA?
Probably a lock as well. Not a huge body of work. Dr. Dre absolutely deserves to be in as a producer. If I would do anything, I would put him in. Certainly rap artists would argue strenuously that NWA belongs in there. I don't think they have one great album, frankly. That's about it. So it gets Dr. Dre and Eazy-E and the other members of the band into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and you're done. That makes sense to me.
The Replacements, also a lock, I think.
Also a lock, absolutely. People are still trying to be as messy and, you know, Rolling Stones-ish as the Replacements were.
Linda Ronstadt, I think she might get in just the sympathy vote might get her. She announced that she had Parkinson's disease early this year.
Right, and she can't sing anymore. And Linda Ronstadt, I don't know what took her so long to get on the list. The woman sang on everybody else's album for like 20 years.
She's one of those people.
All over the place.
Always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Right, a huge presence in the music industry for a long time. You know how great I think she is. And she has the body of work to back it up that's incredibly diverse. And that really makes her a deserving member.
Cat Stevens / Yusuf Islam, both of whom are the same person.
That's right. I would not think he belongs in there. You know, he's got some great songs. I have his greatest hits album. He's got some lovely tunes. I don't think he's got the weight to make it into the Hall.
Well, you know, okay. I was going to make a When You Coming Home joke, but never mind. Link Wray.
People go, who the heck is Link Wray? It's a 50s guitarist. He has the iconic single Rumble. He helped create and popularize the power chord. He, if you're talking about influence, he has influenced a gazillion people. So many people came in his wake. And that's why, in a sense, he kind of belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But I would put the single in there. I put him as a guitarist, but as an artist for his body of work, which is what I think of when you're talking about this area, what we're talking about. I don't think he makes it.
Okay, well, what about Yes?
No!
Okay.
It's progressive. If I can't recommend a single album by somebody, they don't deserve to be in the hall. Yes is famous, progressive rock artist, great, great musicians, incredibly talented, some of the best musicians in the industry when they were at their peak. You know, their first four albums are where anybody can make a case for them. It's certainly long before they got to their pop success. But I just don't see it. I think progressive rock was a dead end. I don't think their music is any good. I wouldn't put them in the hall. But I love looking them up and trying to figure out, you know, what they've done. Maybe I should think twice. What have they done? This is from Wikipedia. Yes, we're unusual in the progressive rock scene of that era because none of its members were drug users. Four members of the classic lineup were vegetarians. The things you learn on Wikipedia. They didn't do drugs. You don't belong in the hall.
So what you're saying is, while Yes has seen all good people, you've seen all good people too, and they weren't a part of it.
That's right. And the last band?
I don't know. What is the last? Oh, the Zombies.
The Zombies. One classic great album, Odyssey and Oracles, that does not a career make. They don't belong in the hall. One could argue the same for Janis Joplin and Nirvana and other artists whose careers were cut short. But in this case, it really is just one album that deserves to be, celebrated as one of the greatest albums of all time if they do that in an album category. But the group as a whole, I don't think so.
Well, Michael, let's move from music straight into publishing because we're running a little long here. So this is a topic, you know, look, we all know Hollywood has bent over backwards to gain access to China's movie audiences. I mean, we've talked about that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they're casting Chinese actors, they're doing these co-productions, and they're censoring anything that the Chinese authorities say, hey, we just want this out of the movie, they'll cut it. Well, now I guess we learn that Hollywood isn't the only one.
That's true. It's same thing is happening in books. Western authors are allowing their books to be censored and edited just so they can get released into that vast marketplace. This is in the New York Times. Ezra F. Vogel is the author of a biography of Deng Xiaoping. You can imagine having written a book about one of China's iconic leaders that you'd wanted to get it released in China. And he did. But he first had to allow them to take numerous sections, be snipped out, such as references to the collapse of communist countries in Eastern Europe and other things that were seen as unfavorable to China or Deng Xiaoping in general. He said, quote, I thought it was better to have 90% of the book available here than zero. That's what he told to the New York Times. And you want to know why? Well, his book sold a pretty good 30,000 copies in the U.S. That's good for a sprawling, sober work about Deng Xiaoping. But it sold 650,000 copies in China.
Now, and I should say that Ezra F. Vogel is still waiting for the check, and he can probably wait
quite
a long time.
How much money did he make off that? He got 20 bucks.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, these issues are less, you know, important for like authors of fiction where they're not going to mess with the story much. There's nothing particularly, you know, sensitive for China. They'd be happy to be in the China market. They'd be happy to have the books out there. But if you're dealing in nonfiction or books that deal with China in general or specifically or books set in China or involving them, then you're going to have a lot of issues about what are you willing to compromise in order to get access to this market. It's a big challenge.
And then there are some people that say, hey, no.
Well, that's right. Like Hillary Clinton said, yes, her book, one of her books was being released in China, but then she found out it was on the shelves and they yanked out whole sections without telling her. And she said, trash all those copies. I want that out of the shelves. That's not what I approved. I don't want to be in there. There's a journalist. His name is James King. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. He's from the Financial Times. He had a book about China. China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future and the Challenge for America. And he wanted to see it released in China, of course, but he couldn't make the deal. They wanted too many things to be taken out, including an entire chapter. And he said, quote, as a journalist committed to accuracy, I felt it would be terrifically hypocritical to waive that principle just to gain access to the Chinese marketplace. So essentially, there's a lot of money to be made. A lot of people want to get their books into China. If you've got a fantasy book or something that's not touchy, you can make a lot of money. Last year, I guess it's 2012, J.K. Rowling grossed $2.4 million in China. I shouldn't say gross. She netted $2.4 million in China. Walter Isaacson, the guy who wrote the Steve Jobs bio, he got about $800,000 out of China. That's a lot of money, especially for
authors. And he did it in suitcases on the backs of... Yeah.
That's a lot of money for authors who are seeing their, you know, their advances dwindle and dwindle in North America and the average price of a book sale getting lower and lower. You know, it's $12, $10, $9. The amount of money they're getting for their books is lowering as well. So that's very, very tempting. And like everything else in Asia and around the world, you got to think about China.
So you're saying that China itself is kind of a big deal.
Well, that goes without saying. It's a big deal. Absolutely.
Okay, that was actually my weak way of getting us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story kind of sticks with publishing because major book retailers in the UK are scrambling to react to press over the self-published books that they stock. It turns out that when millions and millions of people are free to self-publish books and sell them via Amazon and Nook and Kobo and you name it, that you what you wind up with here is some really bad books. And also what many people consider a lot of bad books. And bad is said not like a lamb or a sheep, but with like a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, because the UK's website Kernel started the scandal when it announced it was shocked, they tell you, that there was some erotica section of Amazon, and it included some titles.
Well, it wasn't just erotica.
Okay, well, here's the thing. It included some titles involving rape, incest, bestiality, child abuse, you name it. Retailers reacted with, what do they call that word? Oh, yeah, panic. Amazon UK reportedly removed any erotica that contained words like babysitter and teenager. Kobo took similar major steps for its UK division, while the UK retailer WH Smith, they decided, you know what, let's shut down our entire bookstore for a while. Kernel, which is the company mentioned previously, they followed this up with a report that a wave of Holocaust denial books can also be found at these major outlets. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because of how they reacted. It's a big whoop as far as what they discovered. I mean, when people are allowed to post any book that they want and sell it online, you're going to find a lot of junk and you're going to find a lot of stuff you find objectionable. And I understand how you want to have controls put in place to make sure that children don't access it. Make sure they're not giving it away for free. But since you need a credit card and presumably parents are paying attention to what their kids are buying, we're not talking about kids being handed, you know, vile pornographic material. We're talking about a massive website filled with literally millions of books, and some of them are hateful. And you know what it is? It's like a lot of these books, nobody had seen, nobody had read, nobody had downloaded, nobody had paid for. They were getting zero attention. Some loser would publish literally like a few pages of material. Some of these books, quote unquote, are like a chapter or two long. They're basically short stories, or they're just some rambling comments by somebody that nobody's ever heard of or ever will. So if you're talking about, yes, there's a web and all these people can post their books online and you've never read them and no one's seen them and they're kind of disgusting. Well, okay. I'm not really shocked by that. Was Amazon choosing to publish them? No. Was Kobo choosing to promote them? No. Was anybody making any money off them? No. Do they exist? Yes. Does Amazon and Kobo and these other people not want to be associated with them? I understand it, but the reaction seems to be way over the top. Like, did they remove, Flowers in the Attic, the V.C. Andrews book about brothers and sisters sleeping with each other? Did they remove Lolita? Did they remove Judy Blume's Forever? Of course not. You know, they're just sort of self-choosing to ban all self-published books. It's sort of a queasy censorship that makes me uncomfortable. They're doing with a sledgehammer what they need to be a little bit smarter about.
Isn't that what censorship is all about? It's kind of a sledgehammer?
Yeah, it's not really censorship. They're choosing not to... sell a book. That's not censorship. The people haven't been stopped from publishing their book, making it available online on their blog or anywhere they want, or trying to reach out to some publisher and getting them to publish it, or choosing to publish it themselves. Amazon just said, we don't want to carry it.
Okay.
But it's hard to do with 5 million books. How do you edit and choose and decide what belongs in what category and what you're willing to show? Are you willing to have a book denying the Holocaust, some absurd thing like that on your website? You'd probably rather not, but when there's 5 million books on there, do you really care if something that nobody's ever seen or paid attention to or bought is on there? Maybe not. You know, it's the price you pay.
Speaking of paying prices, director Michael Bay faced a physical assault and an extortion attempt while shooting Transformers 4 in Hong Kong. Bay was on the set when two vendors demanded more money for not playing loud music or otherwise disrupting their shoot. And I thought it was more that they just didn't want the fourth movie made, and that would have been more understandable.
Nice.
They harassed the crew, these vendors, and one returned with what director Michael Bay described as, quote, an air conditioning unit. Because, you know, whenever I'm attacking Michael Bay, I always think, where's my air conditioning unit? Darn it. And, well, this gentleman came back and he swung this air conditioning unit around and swung it at him. And the cops took them all away. Everybody except, you know, Michael Bay, that is, because he had to make, you know, Transformers 4. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Nobody was harmed. People have described first he was wounded, but he was never taken to the hospital. He continued filming. He seemed to be fine. Though it's upsetting to have somebody, you know, threaten you physically in public. That's no fun. But the cops took these guys away, never to be heard from again. I pity these idiots who decided to shake down this studio. China does not want a reputation of an unsafe work environment for Hollywood films. So I don't know what they mean by an air conditioner unit, too. The first description was like, it made it sound like the triad was shaking them down. The next one was like, oh, just some loser vendors. Then the next one said they're waving an air conditioner around. What?
Now the next one will be like, no, it's just some guy moving across the street with a fan.
Yeah, It makes no sense to me whatsoever. But not a good idea, guys.
Now, this next story is it's going to require, I think, Michael, some participation from you because I don't know how to do this.
Oh, I have to do this. Hiya, hiya, hiya.
So that's it. Okay. So maybe we shouldn't.
That's the beginning to the Lion King. It's the circle of life.
I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't have tried to sing it, but it's, as you say, the beginning of the stage musical, The Lion King, and the circle of life now, from my vantage point, is looking a lot more like a circle of money as the Broadway show, which has been there, I guess, 16 years. It's the first one in history to gross more than $1 billion in one location on Broadway. As I mentioned, it's been there 16 years, while The Phantom of the Opera has been there for 25 years. I saw it in its first year. Oh, my God, I am old. While The Lion King has benefited from more than 10 years of premium prices, The Hollywood Reporter emphasizes the show reached $1 billion not by huge top ticket prices, but by consistency. Now, this is a show which has dropped below 80% capacity less than a dozen times in more than 6,600 performances. That's kind of an astonishing figure. Their ticket prices are high, but they're really not gouging. The Lion King's average ticket price is, $130, and the top ticket price is $200, as compared to the Book of Mormon's average ticket price of $171 and a top price of, get this, $477. I can guarantee you I'm not in that seat. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. $1 billion from one run in one city. That is a massive amount of money. It shows how big the stakes are on Broadway. It tells you why they risked $75 million on Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, which, by the way, has rebounded. It's the fall. It rebounded. Last week, it made almost $1 million. This week, it dropped again down to $900,000, a lot better than the last 2 months, but still, they're losing money every single week. So it's not looking better for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. It ain't going to be any Lion King, that's for sure.
Now, here's the thing, and it's talking about my age. And this is a slight aside, but I worked for Disney when they were putting this show together. I was in the New York office, and I remember taking a tour of the New Amsterdam Theater where The Lion King was actually put on. Is it still at the New Amsterdam Theater? I guess it must be, right?
No, absolutely not. No, it moved. Mary Poppins moved in there.
Okay.
Mary Poppins moved in there. It took over after a renovation. It had one of the longest runs in Broadway history. It's in the top 30, I believe. It has shut down. They're renovating it again and getting ready for Aladdin, which is going to open up in March of 2014.
Well, Disney was looking for a place to do this show, The Lion King. And at the time, Times Square and 42nd Street was kind of known for,
dicey.
Yeah, let's just say, it was lots of women of the night tended to walk around there. And lots of, some of that, those erotica films that Amazon won't sell, probably. The New Amsterdam Theater had been closed for years, if not a decade or more. And we had to take the tour of this theater, which was dusty and smelly, and there were rats running around, by flashlight. We took this tour. And of course, now it's they renovated it, and it's Times Square is kind of like the Disney of New York now.
Yeah, it's one of the jewels of Broadway.
That's true. Now, let's talk about ISO Hunt for a second, because Hollywood enjoyed one of its biggest successes against piracy this past week. It reached a settlement with ISO Hunt, one of the largest BitTorrent indexers, for those of you who don't know what ISO Hunt is. And that is, these are sites, these go-to sites for people looking to find and download illegal content of movies and TV shows and records. The site
They point you to the way. They say, hey, you want this movie? Go here.
Exactly. Now, the site is closing down, And it and I guess the MPAA received a judgment of $110 million from ISO Hunt. And the founder of the website, Gary Fung, is prohibited from trying to profit by infringing on MPAA member studios content anywhere in the world. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what I think is interesting. I like the fact that the MPAA went after him and said, look, don't just think you're closing down in the U.S. and you're going to go take your servers somewhere to some island somewhere and, like, reopen. Okay, because that's not going to happen. You're going to be tied to this globally. But what I don't like is that...
How could they enforce it globally?
Well, that's the problem. What I don't like is that the MPAA said, look, we only care about our member studios and everybody else can go suck it.
Well, they can't control. They can't make a... You can't use other people's material. They can't do that.
Yeah, no, I guess you're right in that regard. And really, they're a trade organization for those studio bodies. So you're right. I guess that they're doing what they... They're protecting their employers in a way.
Yeah, and the judgment against ISO Hunt is never going to be collected, actually, right? There's no money to be seized, I assume. It's just you won't ever make any profit off this from what's left, and we're there to grab anything if it shows up.
Precisely.
Okay. Did people make money while it was hot?
I'm sure they did. Everybody always makes money.
So Gary Fung made money? He's rich?
I'm sure he is.
All right. Is this going to stop other people from doing it?
No, it will not.
Okay.
They'll just do it in other ways. Well, now, we talked about the Book of Mormon earlier, right?
And we talked about animated shows, which are often made overseas except for South Park.
That's right, because last week, South Park blew its deadline. And when they did it, you know what they said? Oh, my God, we missed our deadline. See, that's the oh, my God, they killed Kenny.
I get it,
okay, just checking. My jokes are much funnier when they have to be explained. In any case, the animated series from Trey Parker and Matt Stone, also creators of the Book of Mormon, they use cheap animation and last-minute rendering to deliver all these timely episodes that air virtually hours after their final edit. But for the episode titled Goth Kids 3, Dawn of the Posers, you know I had to do that at least once this episode, right?
Absolutely.
Well, okay, well, that episode, Goth Kids 3, it wasn't finished until after it was supposed to air.
Whoops.
Well, the problem here were tight deadlines combined with a power outage. They aired a repeat episode. Instead, this is from Trey Parker. He says, quote, it sucks to miss an air date, but after all these years of tempting fate by delivering the show last minute, I guess it was bound to happen. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's kind of a big deal. I mean, the show was set to air. I turned it on. It was a rerun. I'm like, huh? It's kind of a crazy thing, but nobody cares. It'll be fine. And it just tells you how little Comedy Central watches them and gets to see their shows. You know, they get to see it when we do, essentially. They just trust them to, you know, I mean, they don't really get time to do a lot of, they don't provide feedback, do they?
No. It's basically like, oh, okay. I think they provide feedback on the scripts.
They say, oh, that was nice. Thanks.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's kind of nutty, but the way it's done, it's not a big deal. And nobody will care. Remember, it's just a funny little event. But it tells you when you're cutting it that close to the bone how things can go awry. It's amazing it hasn't happened before.
And frankly, because Comedy Central has become the Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, South Park network, I never know whether I'm watching a new episode or a repeat anyway.
Really? I can't believe they've done 240 episodes.
Yeah, they've been on for years and years. I think, what, 15, 16 years now?
They've been on since...
At least 1996.
Yeah, 1997, it looks like.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah, 1997, and they've done, good God, that's unbelievable.
You know what doesn't make sense?
What?
Actor Martin Sheen, who will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at, get this, the Dubai International Film Festival in December.
My head is exploding.
Now, this is a quote from Mr. Sheen. He says, "This esteemed recognition inspires me to continue doing what I love most, which is being arrested for my political, telling stories through the art of cinema." He goes on to say, "I am very much looking forward to visiting Dubai in December and being immersed in the region's blossoming film industry." Sheen follows in the wake of other honorees like Michael Apted, Oliver Stone, and Sean Penn, all of whom you'd think would never actually go to Dubai. Big deal or big whoop?
Sadly, it's a big whoop. I wish it were a big deal. I wish it was a shameful incident like going to Sun City in South Africa during the apartheid era. I mean, it's just... a few weeks ago that a Norwegian woman was raped in Dubai and reported it to the police, even though the people in the hotel said, for God's sakes, you don't want to tell the cops. But she's like, of course I do. And she told the cops and they arrested her for being a whore because you can't be raped unless you're a whore. And she was jailed and it took the leader of her country to get her out of Dubai.
Wow.
This country has you know, there are some people that say, well, their human rights records are better than other Middle Eastern countries, but that's a low bar. All right. So let's not go by that. Foreign workers are treated very inhumanely, according to Human Rights Watch and a lot of other people. Freedom of religion is basically a joke. That there are a few little houses of worship for other people other than Islam. Freedom of the foreign press is sort of in play, as long as you're not talking about Dubai too much. It's just a country riddled with outrage as far as anybody who cares about basic human rights. Someone like Martin Sheen or Oliver Stone or Sean Penn, who are so politically active in the U.S., to go there and give them their stamp of approval and say, this is a place that's fine to visit. If he doesn't speak out, he should be ashamed of himself. And it's not going to be an occasion for him to speak out. So I just find it embarrassing. I wish people cared more.
Ah, okay.
You know, maybe someday soon they will. Maybe someday soon, taking $1 million like, you know, some of these pop stars have done to perform at parties for despots will become so embarrassing they won't do it anymore. But there are tons of cultural people who have gone to Dubai to get big paychecks. Every year they offer me a free plane ticket and free, you know, come stay for free in Dubai, have a vacation and come to our film festival. They'll pay for the whole thing.
And you say?
No, of course not.
Okay, well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, joining us to discuss, well, I guess it's how record labels are co-opting. Would you say co-opting, Michael?
No, I say they're making use of, they're working with.
They're working with YouTube, the very website they used to load. They're working with them now to help promote all of these new songs. And joining us now to talk about all of this is Don C. Chmielewski from the Los Angeles Times, who wrote a story about this. Don, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Don, we both loved your story, and a good story always has a good lead, and that's exactly what you have here. It sums it up nicely. The lead to your story is, quote, to promote its new song from platinum-selling country music artist Hunter Hayes and Grammy winner Jason Mraz on Tuesday, Warner Music Group didn't book its stars on Good Morning America or Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. It made a video for YouTube. I mean, YouTube really is the place where people go to promote their music now, isn't it? And it's the place where people go to listen to it.
You know, one of the revelations just in reporting out this story is the incredible influence that YouTube has with a demographic, a really young demographic of listeners, teens and young adults who are in their early 20s. It turns out that YouTube actually reaches more of those listeners than does radio or some other platforms that are used to drawing an audience around music, such as MTV or even Yahoo or MySpace. It really is kind of the number one place where young music fans are listening to music.
Another thing I found fascinating was you talked about YouTube being a tastemaker, just like radio DJs used to be a long time ago. I mean, we still have them at KROQ, like Kevin and Bean there. But you wrote, YouTube has elbowed out radio, MTV, Yahoo, and MySpace as the leading way to reach young music listeners, and some of its personalities have emerged as tastemakers, serving much the same role as KROQ's FM's Kevin and Bean have. Now, that's kind of fascinating because these people are sort of personalities and DJs slash performers, because sometimes they just curate songs, sometimes they perform them. In the case of this video, they're performing part of the song and passing along to other people. So it's kind of a new role. They're sort of tastemakers slash entertainers.
Yeah, it's a really interesting phenomenon that I spoke to both Hunter Hayes and Jason Mraz about. I said, what's it make you feel like to have, everyone covering these songs in their own way? And both artists said they were enormously flattered by that. And in fact, Mraz said he's actually altered some of his own performances based on what he's heard from other artists as they perform his work.
Wait, you mean he's actually seen on YouTube a cover of his own work and then said, oh, that's actually a pretty good inflection there.
Yeah, so he's actually, it's at, other performances have actually shaded his work. A filmmaker and a music producer like Kurt Schneider, who attracts more than 3 million subscribers on YouTube, is a very deft filmmaker. In fact, he put together a collaboration that you and I will talk about, and I guess in a bit. But he records covers. He appears with other YouTube artists. And he directed this very unusual collaboration between Jason Mraz, Hunter Hayes, and seven other artists who have attracted substantial followings on YouTube and have musical styles that are very similar to those of these two artists.
That's interesting. What is this collaboration? Because I guess you pointed it out in the piece, but I couldn't exactly figure out, maybe it's my own, maybe I don't know YouTube well enough, but it does seem like there are filmmakers and artists that are getting together on YouTube and becoming cult hits in a way.
Yeah. There's no question that like Gangnam Style or the Harlem Shake, have become these sort of overnight phenomena, on YouTube. And it's something that just ignites on YouTube. And in the case of Psy, generated over a billion views, which was a record even for YouTube, which reaches something on the order of a billion users every month. No, what is intriguing to me about what happened recently here in Playa Vista was that Warner Music recognized that it needs to reach young music fans, and it needs to try new ways to get people to tune into its music and introduce new acts. And so some of its executives were at the South by Southwest conference in Austin, and they got together with some other YouTube execs who were also there at this, sort of media and technology show. And they came up with this idea of a collaboration between signed artists like Hayes and Raz and musicians on YouTube who've built these giant followings online without going through traditional outlets. And so what Warner Music did was they identified a new song that they wanted to release. They reached out to seven musicians, different musicians whose musical styles were compatible with Hunter Hayes's sort of like catchy country inflected music, and asked each of them to record their own versions. And what Warner did was cut in segments of each of these submissions into an audio track that blended with the original recording from Hunter Hayes featuring Jason Mraz, Everybody's Got Somebody But Me. And then so wove together this soundtrack, which blended all of these voices together. And then everyone got together in this one like crazy zany event over at the YouTube facility, and they shot the music video in one long take where Hayes and Mraz were like running through the facility in and out of various studios and hallways and alcoves, meeting up with each of their collaborators and singing. And what Warner Brothers did was it introduced this music video, this collaboration on YouTube, before it started going to more traditional outlets to try to tout this new single.
So instead of going to, say, radio they or television, they went to YouTube and said, okay, it will premiere on YouTube.
Well, here, just a small nuance. I mean, the song has been out for a few weeks, and so this was purely a promotional strategy. It was getting a few plays, getting some plays on, country music stations, but it wasn't, but in an effort to really activate the song and get people of this teens and others sort of interested in it, people who perhaps aren't tuned in to those stations to listen, this collaboration and this music video on YouTube was designed to introduce the song to people who aren't maybe listening in traditional ways.
Well, and what's interesting to me is, I mean, certainly you mentioned Psy and Gangnam Style, but there are people on YouTube who have 1-2 million followers or less, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 followers who aren't, again, like I say, they're more cult hits or niche hits where you wouldn't run across them normally, and yet they have huge followings and are tastemakers.
Mm-hmm. It's true. This Chris Schneider that I was mentioning is one example of that. And there are a number of independent artists who have built substantial followings. A lot of them often will start with covers and begin to build out a career that blends sort of, they'll record covers of music, and that will give them time to write their own original compositions, which they'll introduce once they've attracted a substantial following. And some, have transitioned to major label deals, but the ecosystem is such now that an independent artist can sell tracks through iTunes or through Google Play, and can begin touring because they know who their fans are, and they can use the platform to promote, and can make a living with their music, or at least bring in some income from this thing that they love.
Well, in fact, while doing the research for this particular interview, I ran across Austin Mahone, who is this YouTube sensation. He's been in a McDonald's ad, and now he's suffering from exhaustion, and he had to cancel his MTV One to Watch tour, and he opened for Taylor Swift. I mean, and this is all from performing on YouTube.
You know, in a way, it's not dissimilar from, you know, artists that emerge on other major platforms like television. I mean, for decades, TV shows have become launching pads for young acts. And, you know, before that, it was, you know, Wolfman Jack, you know, introducing audiences to new sounds. So this is simply a new but much broader and global platform for musicians to get known.
Well, wouldn't some people be somewhat pessimistic about this and say, well, look, you know, Justin Bieber was discovered on YouTube. So, you know, it's finally record companies are just getting on the bandwagon. They're finally waking up to this. Are record companies late to the party?
This is a new world, and they're the way that they identify artists, their artist and repertoire techniques have certainly evolved, and A&R people are taking advantage of these new platforms. And so they're far more attuned to YouTube than perhaps they were a decade ago when Napster came around and shook up their business.
I guess that's a good thing, since Napster didn't exactly, you know, help them in any way.
No, it didn't.
But in this case, you point out that YouTube, in collaboration with YouTube, a record label can actually post a song or a collaboration like the one with Jason Mraz and Hunter Hayes here, and they can actually earn advertising revenue through a revenue share with YouTube. But does that actually go to the artist or to the record label? Because it's technically going to the label, not the artist.
Right. And I'm not, you'll have to forgive me, I'm not an expert in this form of compensation. So I can't accurately tell you exactly how the money flows, but I do know that the labels end up often being collection agents for these sorts of payments and royalties. Beyond that, I can't tell you how or how quickly the money trickles down to the artist.
I think even the artists and those that are well-versed in that type of remuneration couldn't tell you. That's part of the problem, is that it's, it's kind of a gray area. It's not exactly a performance fee. It's not exactly a royalty. It's this weird middle ground or middle area where there's a partnership between YouTube and the record company, not YouTube and the artist.
Although you'll note, of course, that every major artist has his or her own channel on YouTube now. In fact, if you go to YouTube, I haven't done the check today, but invariably 9 of the top 10 videos on the site are music videos.
Well, do you feel that somehow traditional television, if that's what you want to call it, will pick up on this, and all of a sudden there'll be another MTV for this particular generation? They'll try and launch a network around these weird things called music videos.
they're actually starting actually today. There is a new music video channel called Revolt TV. It's actually based here in Los Angeles, and it is backed by Sean Diddy Combs, who wants to bring back the music video and bring back a more curated sensibility to what's hot on, you know, in music, and that includes, you know, music that you can see online. So it's available here in LA and on other cable networks. And they're going to try to introduce the concept of music television or MTV, but in a way that acknowledges social media, you know, and how dynamic the conversation is between music fans and artists. So I've not seen any of the programming yet, but it's an interesting attempt for traditional media to try to reclaim this space.
Well, if it doesn't work out, they can always in 20 years or maybe even 10 years just turn around and, put a whole bunch of, people who don't know each other together in an apartment in New York or San Francisco and just film it all.
There you go.
A whole network full of that, but still call it music television or whatever they're going to, Revolt Music. Yeah. One thing that interested me here is that you mentioned this phrase Generation C, which is actually a Google coined phrase, and you defined it as, you know, those having laptops between the ages of 18 and 34, you know, who watch media on laptops and, and tablets and their phones. And I thought, well, okay, that's just about everybody.
Yeah, it is. But these are, I mean, it's actually, I think I've actually seen Nielsen use this terminology in some of its own studies, but it talks about a generation for whom, you know, a generation that grew up around, or can't remember a time before the internet, and who, you know, are avid consumers of media and who are on all of these devices and in fact are almost primarily using these other devices. So they have different forms of discovery, different habits. It's not to say that they aren't entertained by television and movies. They are, but the way that they're accessing entertainment is very different from their parents or perhaps their older siblings.
Well, certainly, I thank you for taking the time, and I'm speaking for both Michael and myself, for taking the time to join us and try and explain how record labels have kind of gotten wise to YouTube and are now actually, rather than fighting it, actually encouraging its use to promote their own music.
Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was fascinating. YouTube really is the new radio. It used to be the place that you hated because people were playing your songs. They were doing covers of it. You weren't getting enough residuals back. Now it's a place where they're making money and they're helping promote music and helping to promote sales, and they love it.
It's a whole new world.
Is that an Aladdin reference?
That's right. I was trying to play off of The Lion King, but I just couldn't do it.
No, that's fine. The Aladdin is opening where The Lion King first played. Aladdin opens in March of 2014. It's a very good reference.
At the New Amsterdam Theater.
That's right. On 42nd Street in Times Square. Come to New York, people.
Now, I would just like to warn Disney, we will be by for our check for that plug.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I just wanted to let everybody know that you can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever you pick up podcasts for free. We're free. We don't charge. Of course, you can donate to us, but that's another story. So subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in those podcast marketplaces. It does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you should find our page. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, on their website, who is mgmt.com. And of course, also, well, they're kind of done playing in Europe for the month of October, but starting in November, they're going to be back here in the United States at Austin, Texas on November 10th. Michael, you have a website. What is it this week?
It's michaelgiltz.com.
Michaelgiltz.com. That's where you can find all of Michael's writing for the Huffington Post and other places. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Every week, do you feel like, I have to do all this stuff at the end? You don't have to do anything. You just sit around while I do all this work naming all these things. It's so hard. Nobody appreciates me.
No, I've never thought that, actually. My goal is just to try and say it as quickly as possible in an understandable manner.
Success!